ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is ABC Radio National.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor, and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. I've got a confession to make. When I did my Australian duty and listened to the Triple J Hottest 100 back in January, I must have looked like the human form of the shrug emoji. Who were all these bands? What were all these songs? I listen to music all the time, but recent stuff? How can it possibly compete with the nostalgia-soaked tunes of my late teens that still dominate my playlists? In the next 20 minutes, why old favourites hit so hard and how streaming makes it even tougher for new music to cut through. Also ahead, Nicole Kidman's announced she wants to train as a death doula. So what is that exactly? It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, hospital food isn't exactly known for its fine dining credentials. If you've ever spent time on a ward, you know the kind of meals that show up on that little tray. They're practical, they're predictable, but have you thought about how they get there? If you think of all of the patients on all of the floors in all of the hospitals, you realise it's a remarkable amount of food. And it's not just hospitals. The government is also feeding people in aged care homes, prisons, defence facilities, long day care centres and more. So a new report has mapped out, for the first time, Australia's food procurement system, and the numbers are staggering. The report is called Transforming the Public Plate for People, Place and Planet. It estimates that around $2.1 billion is spent on food, with long and complex supply chains behind every meal. But is it being done as well as it could be? Experts say the system is falling short, especially when it comes to nutritional value and the environment and support for local industry. With me is Leah Galvin, a Churchill Fellow and the project lead of the report released by Good Food Purchasing Australia. Leah, welcome to Life Matters.
Good morning, Tegan, and to your listeners. Thanks for having us.
So, Leah, hospital food, to take the probably the example that most people have had a touchstone with, it's always had a bit of a reputation. It's not meant to be a fine dining experience. Why was it important to you to look into this?
It's important for a few reasons. And obviously, if you've got a loved one in hospital recovering, then we all know that nutrition and so the meals is an important part of their recovery. But at the moment, we have a system where, because of the nature of the purchasing of food, it's really quite difficult for people working in food service kitchens to serve up the best.
How many Australians are eating these meals? And like, who are they?
It's literally millions of meals each year because of all of those different settings that you mentioned, residential aged care, hospitals, long day care, so that's our kids, even the defence system, Meals on Wheels, schools in some places as well, and even Antarctica. All of these settings, governments, whether they're state or the Commonwealth, having food purchased for the meals made in those settings.
So it's not one single supply chain, but it's definitely a centralised system.
At a state level, it's very centralised. There's generally centralised contracts. This is a bit dry, this material, but the part of the problem is that we're seeing that those centralised systems are quite dominated by large multinationals, often offshore foreign-owned suppliers. And what we'd like to see is changes that could create pathways for small, medium, local and even First Nation producers to participate. And this could deliver huge benefits for the health, sustainability and also the resilience of our food system in Australia.
So you mentioned small producers, Indigenous-owned producers, etc. What are the barriers to them being part of this system at the moment?
At the moment, the system really tries to streamline as much as it possibly can and have as few providers as possible. Whereas when we look to the overseas models, they're trying to, in fact, do something quite different and create systems that allow small and medium businesses to participate and really relocalising that procurement so that within a region, for example, a district hospital or something could look to, you know, local farmers and really contribute to those thriving farming communities.
It's Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm talking to Leah Galvin, who's the project lead for Good Food Purchasing Australia, about a new report that for the first time has mapped all of the different centralised food channels in Australia. You've probably had a meal in a hospital at least once before. You might have encountered meals in aged care or defence or prison. If it's something that you've had a touch point with, I'd love to know what you made of those meals, whether you'd do something differently if it was up to you. One person says, hospital food is shocking. It's time for a change for all food chain suppliers. Another said, I work in a children's prison and the catered food there is universally disliked and wasted. Children beg for agency around food choices, and this is a missed opportunity for learning about health and nutrition and the benefits of shared meal preparation. Another says, we were surprised at how much food waste is being tolerated and started building fully autonomous robotic kitchens here in Brisbane to address this problem. Healthcare, aged care, defence and government services is only a small portion of the problem. If you look at the material effect that staffing shortages has in the sector on immigration, you see how this is a contributor to some of Australia's biggest problems. There are so many tentacles to this, Leah. How do you untangle it so that you could start recommending changes?
Well, I love those comments because it really demonstrates that there's so many different touch points and perspectives on this. But what's been important for us in this work is to really look at what has worked successfully overseas. Like, we're about 20 years behind some locations. I did a Churchill Fellowship in 2022 and visited seven different countries to look at the models and approaches that are being used. And they've really progressed quite a long way. And it's been, importantly, it's been a way to help different countries to prepare their food systems for things like climate change, to create more jobs, and also to really contribute to local economies as well as those health and well-being outcomes, because it's so important that people in these settings who we would often consider to be at risk of being food insecure are getting the best food they possibly could. It should be fresh, it should be tasty, it should be local, and the overseas example shows that that's quite achievable.
Like you said, there's aspects around sustainability and that sort of thing that I want to get into, but I really want to talk about nutritional quality. Also here with us is Dr. Stephanie Godrich, Senior Lecturer of Public Health in Nutrition at Edith Cowan University. Stephanie was also involved in the report. Stephanie, were you surprised by what you were seeing when it came to the nutritional quality of the meals?
Yes, I was, because like Leah said, often the people that are in these institutions might be vulnerable, or vulnerable points of their lives, like children. You know, they really need to be set up for achieving their best in terms of health, their educational outcomes. People in hospital recovering possibly from surgery or illness, and also thinking about people in aged care. They're at the older stages of their life, and so they have different nutritional needs as well. So yes, we were surprised, and as Leah mentioned about the overseas examples, it was heartening to see how far ahead they are and really what we can learn from these other countries.
Yeah, I want to get to that. One of the things I wanted to also mention, Stephanie, is aged care is one of the sectors we're talking about here. There was the Royal Commission into Aged Care. Quality and nutrition was one of the big focus points of that Royal Commission. Have we seen improvements since then?
Well, we know that in November 2025, there was the new standard that has come into place, so the strengthening aged care quality standards, and that brings about a significant change. And so there is the new standard 6, which focuses on food, nutrition and dining. So it has a quality statement where meals need to be nutritious, they have to have variety, they need to be appetizing for people, safe, and in line with the needs and preferences of older people. And thinking also more broadly than just the nutrition, it has to support an enjoyable dining experience for people and a sense of belonging, because that is such a part of that rhythm of the day. People in aged care look forward to those meals and coming together and socialising as well.
Leah, that sounds like a lot of things that one meal service is meant to be doing when there's a budget for this. And at the moment, we're looking at $2 billion, north of $2 billion. How do you balance the need to keep things economical with the sorts of things that Stephanie's mentioning there?
Oh, great question, Tegan. And one of the really important findings of this that's in the report is that, in fact, we've found that these sort of healthy, sustainable, relocalising approaches actually don't necessarily cost more. In fact, there were many examples where it actually saved money, plus creating these other benefits of the food being fresher and, you know, adding to the local economic activity, which is really important in our region. So I think price shouldn't be a reason for why we wouldn't do this work, but really, at the moment, all we're doing is focusing on best price rather than best practice. And best practice does include those other elements. So health, sustainability, considering economies, sourcing locally, they're the things that we can include in the system. And also factoring how we include small and medium businesses so that we reduce the domination of large multinationals at the moment.
It's Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Leah Galvin from Good Food Purchasing Australia and Dr. Stephanie Godrich from Edith Cowan University about how we could maybe do a better job of providing good food in places like hospitals, aged care, prison, defence force, these centralised food procurement channels in Australia. Maybe not something you've thought about before, although if you've had one of these meals, maybe you have thought about it. I'd love you to tell me about that experience. You are sending me a lot of texts. It really seems to be quite a mixed bag throughout here. Anne says, I've had two different hospital admissions in the last 6 months. What surprised me was the high sugar foods on the menu. Every meal had fruit juice and a soft, easy to eat dessert. I would imagine when people are not feeling very well, these foods would be eaten in preference to, in inverted commas, real food. Another says, Chef Stefano De Pieri in Mildura is transforming the meals at Mildura Hospital. Another compliment for Mater Mothers Public Hospital in Brisbane from Belinda said, I was pleasantly surprised by the quality of the food. So, Leah, it's obviously possible for these institutions to do things well. We've heard the Brisbane example and the Mildura example. What would it take to broaden that across the whole country?
Well, that's very encouraging, isn't it? And this is actually what we found when we were doing this piece of research too, is there's real inconsistency. But it really shouldn't matter which institution, which hospital, which aged care provider you're in. You should be able to be sure that the food's going to be tasty, fresh, delicious, and that you're going to enjoy it. So what we know we need to do to actually address these problems is similar to the overseas models, is that we need to introduce some mandatory targets, legislate for healthy, local, sustainable food, and for standards for public food purchasing. And right now, it couldn't come at a more critical time with Australia's food systems and supply chains all at risk because of the fuel crisis. So this really needs to be, we need to seize this moment and get on with it.
Stephanie, you mentioned before that you were pretty inspired by what you saw in other countries. What would you call out specifically there?
Well, some examples are in France. They mandate that 50% of their school meal ingredients are locally sourced. And then in other countries like Brazil and Uruguay, they legislate that at least 30% of the public food budgets purchase from family-owned farms, which are closer to where the institutions are located. And so those two examples for me, I live in a rural area. There are lots of farmers near where I live. And thinking about how vitally important that would be for their businesses to keep the economy in these rural areas supported. We know that farmers are finding it really difficult right now in Australia. And so to think that we could shift the budgets towards supporting more of these smaller family-owned farms, I think is absolutely fantastic. But then also thinking about the nutrition standards across 14 European Union 14 countries had nutrition criteria, and I thought that that was quite amazing to see how many just in the European Union were focusing on better nutrition for people in these institutions. And then also thinking about the USA, where institutions are serving breakfast, lunch, and dinner, they're required to serve 5 different servings of fruits and vegetables. So these are great opportunities to make sure that people in these institutions are meeting their nutritional needs while they're there.
So Leah, one of the other big focus points for this study was about environmental sustainability. What is the environmental impact of the current system?
Well, it's probably news to many people to hear that, in fact, our food system contributes 1/3 of our emissions here in Australia. So when we're talking about food system, we're talking about all of the things from soil health, growing and harvesting of food, distribution, wholesaling, retail, and also the management of waste as well. So it's a large impost. It's CSIRO last year published a very interesting report saying that they estimate that the environmental hidden cost for food systems at the moment is about somewhere in the vicinity of $250 billion a year in Australia. So that means that at the moment, the way we're producing food, the way we're distributing food is causing climate impact. So we really need to reconsider that. And that was actually one of the things that was quite popular in some surveys we did with people looking at sort of sentiment around the things that they wanted included in food purchasing. And like 3 in 4 people have said that they would prefer governments to be more mindful about the climate impacts of the food that they're purchasing.
Leah, what are the long-term costs of not getting this right?
Well, I think the fuel crisis is showing us at the moment what some of those might look like. Relying on long supply chains is really risky. We really need to consider these relocalisation approaches. It's interesting to, you know, Google and see what the rest of the world's talking about. We're all having the same conversation. We're all talking about how we need to shorten our supply chains. And actually, that's one way to reduce climate impact as well. We need to decrease our reliance on foods coming from overseas and from long distances, particularly when we produce those foods here in Australia. I live in Tasmania, and we discovered that, in fact, the Tasmanian government is buying raspberries from Chile, even though Tasmania is the largest producer of raspberries in Australia. So there are some crazy things going on in the procurement system that if we made the investment in, you know, sort of the infrastructure that can help manage this middle piece between farms and what kitchens need, and then also had these mandatory targets, we could certainly turn it around.
Stephanie, do we underestimate the importance of food for the groups of people that find themselves in places like hospitals, aged care facilities, long day cares?
I think so, because like we've talked about, not only can it meet their nutritional requirements, you know, we know that people in, for example, aged care have higher nutritional needs, particularly around protein, trying to reduce risk of falls, trying to help them recover faster from illness and injury, but also thinking about children in daycare. You know, they're young, their brains and bodies are developing. And if they don't get all the foods that they need, we can see issues like iron deficiency, poor growth and development. They can have serious and lifelong impacts on children. And so if we can provide people, particularly children, with nourishing food to set them up for life, that's really going to help boost their capacity for learning, you know, their health and well-being. And so it's really helping their whole bodies. So that's why we want to see ingredients that are tasty, fresh, local. So if that food is good, tastes good, looks good, children are more likely to enjoy it. But also people in hospitals, you know, it's something to look forward to. It's delicious. People in aged care, it's meeting their nutritional needs to help them live a better quality of life for longer.
So Leah, what's next in this project? You've quantified it. What next?
So as a response to the report, Good Food Purchasing Australia has been formed, and we're a newly formed action-oriented initiative. And our objectives are around connecting policy, research and praxis, because we want to transform how Australian governments are sourcing and purchasing food at the moment. We're going to bring together experts across health, agriculture, environment, purchasing and community wellbeing to advocate for a smarter and fairer and more sustainable public food system, which we think is absolutely possible here. And we can increase the use of fresh local produce and redirect that spending to Australian farmers and producers and produce real benefits for Australia.
Leah, Stephanie, thank you both so much for joining me. Leah Galvin is a Churchill Fellow and the project lead of the report released by Good Food Purchasing Australia. Dr. Stephanie Godrich is Senior Lecturer of Public Health Nutrition at Edith Cowan University. And thanks for sharing your thoughts as well. Robin says, I've worked as a public hospital dietitian and have been shocked by the change in focus in the food service system. As dietitians, we had no power to change the menu apart from it meeting minimum requirements and appropriate for medical conditions like allergies. Whenever we tried to address the problem, food service just said that they receive very few complaints from patients. Unfortunately, asking patients to complain is difficult but powerful. Food services is driven by dollars, not nutrition. Well, stick around because coming up next here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, I want you to name one new song that you've discovered this year. You've got about 30 seconds to figure it out. And if you can't name one, there's a good reason why. And I've got someone who can help with that.
On Radio National, we revisit history.
This woman would emerge with a legacy that would last centuries.
From unexpected events, this is the beginning of the end.
To the deeper forces behind them.
Suddenly, 200 times as much could be made.
On Radio National, we revisit the turning points.
To the people assessing her, she's absolutely insane.
The past 250 years have seen an unprecedented surge in innovation.
The sliding door moments of history.
ABC Radio National.
Be honest, when was the last time you had the thrill of discovering a new band from a brand new artist and it made you feel the way you did hearing Midnight Oil or Powderfinger or the Divinyls? It's probably been a while. It's pretty normal to hit an age where life takes over, you've got bills to pay, and finding new music falls to the bottom of your to-do list. And honestly, why would you bother when any number of streaming services can curate your own personal greatest hits at the literal push of a button? But it turns out that's not just keeping you in your bubble, it's changing the kind of music that gets made in the first place. New research shows a dramatic decline in sales of new music over the last 20 years, and it's creating a nostalgia spiral that could mean even when you want to find new music, it all sounds the same. I've got one of the ABC's best music minds with me to give you a few tracks to break out of that rut. And I will say, if you are listening on podcast to catch up, unfortunately, I can't play you the music that we did on the radio for copyright reasons. So you'll just have to use your memory and your thumbs to find that music. But first, Tim Kelly is the head of music business at the Australian Institute of Music. He's been researching the state of new music in Australia. He's also worked at the top levels of the Australian record industry. Tim, welcome to Life Matters.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Why does it feel so hard to find new music?
It's an interesting conversation because in one sense, there's more choice than ever. You know, nearly all the music that's ever made is available on streaming platforms. But there's this concept called the tyranny of choice, which is where people have too much choice. They get overwhelmed and their behaviours actually become more conservative. And I think that couples with the design of streaming platforms in terms of encouraging passive listening. And as you said, the, you know, I can't think of what to play. I'll just play a playlist and someone else can choose it for me.
Okay. So a playlist curated by someone else. Why is that a problem? Isn't that what we're doing when we're turning on the radio anyway?
Kind of, but the someone else is actually an algorithm. And I think there's a distinct difference between human curation and data-led curation. Data-led curation via algorithms will serve you more of what you're already consuming. It will make the calculation, you listen to X, I'm going to give you more X. When we have conversations as humans, we tend to lead with expert-led recommendation. And often that takes a tangent. If someone says they like a particular artist, you don't say, well, here's someone else nearly the same. You actually go off on a tangent and pick up some aspect of that artist and recommend from there.
So me listening to whatever on repeat from the early 2000s in a vacuum isn't a problem, but you're saying that this sort of behaviour is influencing the kind of new music that gets made and gets promoted?
I think there's, you know, again, there's some really interesting juxtapositions in the music economy at the moment, because it's easier than ever to release music, and more people than ever are releasing music. It's about 100,000 songs a day. And, you know, back in the 80s, it was about 100,000 singles a year. So there's been huge growth in terms of the ability of people to release music. But less of it is being heard. And as the competition to be heard becomes more intense, there's real strong gravities to conform to what the platforms say is working, and the labels as well. It's not just the streaming platforms, it's also the labels. But the key thing here is that the outcome of streaming is that we're listening to less new music. So just in context, the music, recorded music, peaked in the early 2000s in the CD age, and then the internet and piracy wiped out over half the value of the music industry over the next 14 years, which is obviously a huge event. And streaming has turned that around. The recorded music has grown with streaming. It's now back up to just slightly more than the levels it was in 2014, which was the low point. But new music has continued to decline. New music in Australia in 2024 was only 4% up from 2014, and that's when taking into account inflation. So in reality, it's down 30%. So the takeaway from this is that streaming saved recorded music, but it hasn't saved new music, and I think industry needs to take that really seriously to regenerate itself.
Well, also here with me is Dan Condon, music editor at Double J. And you can't see this, but I can. He's wearing a T-shirt of the band behind my very first CD that I had, TLC. So you'll have a bit of nostalgia as well then, Dan.
Oh, I do, absolutely. And I think it's natural to gravitate towards stuff. And look, the nostalgia, it serves so many purposes. There's a comfort element to it. There's the fact that, look, these are still good songs. You know, that first TLC record is still incredible. But yeah, I mean, look, I mean, I can certainly only speak anecdotally and from what I glean through my work, not so much like Tim has just a bevy of statistics and proper research. But it all does really align. And this idea of choice paralysis is something that, you know, I myself on the bus in this morning, I just sat there in silence for the first 60 seconds because I had absolutely no idea what I wanted to play. I was looking at my streaming service and I could have listened to anything at all. And it's a real thing. And even though I'm spending all of my days surrounded by music, I mean, it's that urge to go to something familiar and something that you know you like, it's real.
How many new artists are you trying to sample, say, in a given month, Dan?
Yeah, I was interested to hear that kind of 100,000 a day. Not surprised at all. Just the influx of new music is truly staggering. Look, the only answer I can give to that is as much as I can. But you can't listen to everything. And that's you know, the sad truth. And so you do rely on a sense of curation. You know, I work in curation, but I'm also leaning on other people all around the world to tell me, oh, this is really great. This is worth your time. Because, you know, if you waste time on something that's not so good, then you might not get to something that's really great. So I find that, yeah, that kind of expert-led discovery is really important, and sad that it is kind of diminishing.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, chatting with Dan Condon, music editor at Double J, and Tim Kelly from the Australian Institute of Music about why you are stuck in a nostalgia spiral. It's kind of your brain. It's also had a lot to do with streaming, the sheer volume of new music that's coming out. And Tim, at least, reckons it's a problem because it affects the kind of new music that is being made and promoted by record labels. So I'm asking you, if you've managed to break out of a rut, what are you listening to at the moment? Lots of recommendations here. Craig says this is very topical because I hear most of my new music via 2SER. Unfortunately, the community radio station is now fighting to stay alive. Big ups to community radio across Australia. 57-year-old texter says, Father of Peace Bluish. Thank you, Rob from Port Fairy, for that one. Nice to have that musical frisson at 57. Colin says, I'm 66. My favourite new song is Build Me a House from the new CD by Queen Porter Stomp. I was at their album launch on Friday night. some pretty cool kids on the text line. Dan, you've already got some new Australian music that you've got to get out, to wet our whistles, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's no shortage. I have to be honest with you. I haven't heard either of those songs that your listeners have suggested. I'm going to have to go and listen to them after this.
So first of all, you've got Sometimes by Meg Mac. So not a super new artist.
No, and that's something that I think is also really interesting. Obviously, discovering new artists is vital because, you know, what's going to happen? These artists will just, you know, be undiscovered forever. Now, Meg Mac is not a new artist, but she's kind of entering, I guess, a new stage of her career, mid-30s now, and she was in her early 20s when she broke out. There's been this kind of narrative that once a woman turns 30, she's no longer viable as a pop musician or as a musician, which is obviously nonsense. And that's something that certainly at Double J, where I work, we're really keen to support artists through that kind of middle stage of their career. And look, an artist like Meg Mac, she's come and put out this new album this year, and it's a real genuine, real difference to what she's done before. It's, you know, she's taken on in some ways more of a pop kind of a sound, but also lyrically, I mean, you know, she's not in her early 20s anymore. So her experiences are informing her lyrics in very different ways. And we're seeing, you know, the growth of this artist. And that's something that while so important to get around these artists when they're really emerging, it's also important to not forget about them when they're on album 4 or 5.
Dan, what is it about this song that you love?
I really like the acknowledgement in the chorus, which you just played there, is that sometimes you got to do something to make you feel better, even if people don't like it. And it's like, that's such a mid-30s realization of just like, oh, maybe I don't need to please everyone all the time. And that's something that she probably wouldn't have put in a song, you know, 10 years ago. And I love just seeing the growth, because I grow with these artists. We all grow with these artists as well. And we're not the same people we were 15 years ago. And that has gone kind of in line with this musical change, which in some ways lines up with what pop music is doing. There's certainly some elements of that kind of Chapel Roan style pop that comes into it, but also very much just sounding herself and familiar and comforting and all those things that we love for music from the past.
So your other recommendation is Shadowland by Bad Dreams. This sounds like classic 80s Aussie rock to me. It's super nostalgic.
Yeah, it does. And they make no apologies for that. They're very proud to wear those influences, you know, Midnight Oil, etc., on their sleeve. But they are giving it a fresh sound as well. If you listen to the new Bad Dreams album, Ultra Dundee, it doesn't necessarily sound like a Midnight Oil album. It's definitely a Bad Dreams album. And like, you know, like Meg Mac, they have their own perspectives on what's happening in Australia today, especially. And it's very much an album for 2026, even though it sounds a little bit like an album from 1986.
Tim, what do you make of this? Is this nostalgia, like, are they nostalgia baiting, or is this just like I'm following this rich tradition of Australian music?
I think it's a bit of both. I think without doubt we live in nostalgic times. I mean, the fact that we need to remake Harry Potter kind of blows my mind in a way, after only 20 years or so. And we do live in nostalgic times, but, you know, there's nothing wrong with the nostalgia in itself. And there's nothing wrong with artists taking their cues from what's gone on in the past and then developing that and creating a modern expression of that in their music. This is all good stuff. But I also think music needs people who are pushing the envelope and changing music. And I don't think we've had that flavour in our musical lives for some time. You know, to be nostalgic, if we go back to the last century, something pushed the envelope of music basically every 7 years, if you go through the history of it. You know, if we're going back with grunge and rock and EDM and hip-hop and all these musical genres that kind of came through, and we're seeing less of that, and I think we're particularly seeing less of that at scale. So this starts with recorded music, but actually flows on to the rest of the economy, because a lot of festivals are struggling to get new live acts to really boost the excitement of their lineups, because not enough artists are cutting through at scale and becoming household names. And so there's it's about getting this balance between loving and respecting what's gone on before, but also creating a condition for new things to come through. And right now, the industry is very safe because they're making money for Rope by selling catalogue recordings, old music, where all the costs have been amortised, and they're struggling to find a way to generate new stars for the future. And I think part of that is due to the fact that there's no incentive for business incentive for record labels to chase new music, because there's no distinction in streaming between the value of a song, whether it's active or passive or new or old.
So one innovative suggestion on the text line, this person says, I would love it if our supermarkets could adopt a policy of playing new and Australian music rather than the old predictable tunes of artists who have already made it. Dan, what do you reckon?
I mean, I'm never going to argue with that. I think I would say, why stop at supermarkets? Let's do it everywhere. I may be a little biased and I probably need to be a bit careful. Being a journalist, probably shouldn't be lobbying too much, but I think there's no way that we can have too much exposure to great Australian music. And as we've said, the quantity is there and the quality is there. The fact that we're kind of eschewing it in some of these areas is just wild.
So you're giving me your recommendations on the text line. Gillian says, I'm in my 70s and love pop music. Favourites at the moment, Olivia Dean, Caroline Polachek, Chapel Roan and Taylor, of course. I'd love it if you were talking about me, Gillian, but I suspect you're talking about Taylor Swift. Locally, Missy Higgins, Emma Donovan, Vera Blue and Montaigne. Another says, I've been listening to a streaming service that allows musicians to upload their own music and I find heaps of new music, which is mostly electronic. However, I'm really enjoying Christabel and the Sea. Dan, where are your recommendations? Where are you looking for new stuff?
I mean, that changes, it evolves constantly. I think the most important thing is to remain open. If you're interested in listening to new music, and I believe everyone should be because it is rewarding to hear and to discover new stuff. But look, I mean, I'm not ignoring the algorithms from the streaming services. I do use them. I don't get a lot of value out of them, if I'm being honest. I get a lot more value when a friend texts me and says, oh, you'd love this song. And, you know, even though I listen to music all day, every day as my job, very privileged, the fact is I miss so much. So I'm always relying on, you know, blogs, on social media, word of mouth, radio, of course, community radio, my own station, Double J, that I work for. Our music directors are always getting me into new music. I think that if you can remain open, and I understand I'm in a privileged position where that's something that I have more time to do. But I do think staying open to these recommendations from everywhere, preferably not algorithmic recommendations, because I completely agree with what Tim said, that the value of them just isn't as strong. But yeah, being open everywhere, you know, if you hear a song on an ad that you like, then, you know, there's an app now. You can just scan it and find out what it was.
See, in that way, it is easier than ever to find it, which is great. Tim, from the industry perspective, or what can we do as consumers to put the pressure on industry? How does industry need to respond to this?
Well, I mean, as consumers, obviously, the more we consume new music, then that's going to help industry and they're interested in new music. And I think, as Dan was saying, if you just rely, if you're totally passive, you'll just get whatever you're served. But if you can get some time and find out the people who you trust and listen to their recommendations, it's a really rewarding experience. But I guess my research is trying to argue that industry needs to do something for itself. In the CD age, there was a difference in price between new release and old music, in that new release sold at full price and catalogue sold at mid price. So the business was incentivized to chase new music because there was greater margin in the value of sales. And right now that doesn't exist. And maybe that could be a way of carving up the revenue that comes through. There'll be lots of reasons why people will argue against it, but something... I think industry needs to do something to incentivize itself to discuss, to promote and generate more new music. Because if it doesn't, industries that don't regenerate themselves don't tend to have a very good future. You know, I think industry needs to do something for itself here rather than relying on us as consumers.
Tim, Dan, thank you both so much for chatting with me today. Tim Kelly's the head of music business at the Australian Institute of Music. He's been researching the state of new music in Australia. Dan Condon, music editor at Double J. Listen to it. Take a break from ABC Radio National every now and again. Dan and his colleagues have a podcast called Shortcut, where you can find some new music recommendations. You're listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, Nicole Kidman says she's training to be a death doula. Maybe not a role you'd thought about before, but my next guest says in Western cultures, we could stand to think a bit more about what a good death can look like.
Meet the artistic director.
The theatre we make, it's visceral.
And the new CEO.
What do you think of theatre, Julia?
Didn't realise they were still doing it.
The Argonne is having a few tiny financial issues.
For some, the world's a stage. For others, it's a spreadsheet.
She has got to go.
These are theatre folk. They won't go down easy.
Anne Edmonds and Kitty Flanagan star in the brand new comedy.
If this is all so easy, why don't you do it?
Bad Company. Starts Sunday, April 26th on ABC TV and ABC iView.
The idea of a birth doula, someone who supports you through bringing life into the world, is now pretty understood. But at the other end of life, it's a very different story. So Nicole Kidman, the actress, you know who I'm talking about, has revealed she's training to become a death doula following the loss of her mum, which is a personal decision for her that has ignited interest in what that role actually is. Because while death is something every single one of us will face, we don't always think about how supported we are through it. So what does a death doula do? Why are more people starting to see value in this kind of care? With me is Simon Braun-Freck, a PhD student at the School of Engineering and the Death Tech Research Team at the University of Melbourne. Simon is also an end-of-life doula. Simon, what is an end-of-life doula? What sort of things are you doing?
Hi, yeah. So the work of an end-of-life doula does range depending on the doula and what their clients ask of them. But typically, the way that the role's explained is they're a third-party advocate who works on behalf of a dying individual to help support their wishes through their death journey and then even post-mortem with their funeral practices.
What are you able to bring in that role that a family member might struggle to do?
A lot of it is experience with dying, grief, bereavement, but also just a type of death literacy that comes from working with dying and with the training that a lot of doulas go through. So a lot of families might not have experienced a death before, or if they have, it's been different from other types of death they've experienced in their life. And so this other person there in the room can act as a neutral party who's bringing in more depth and more experience to this really vulnerable, confusing time.
We're in a weird point in history in Western culture in that we're actually quite removed from death in a way that a lot of other cultures aren't and that most humans in history haven't been. Am I reading that right?
Yeah. So Western death culture has been talked about as being death avoidant for a few decades at this point. And what that really means is that it's been shown that Western death culture doesn't really like to talk about death. That's the theory. In practice, I've actually found people do want to talk about death when they hear that I work in death. They often want to tell me their own personal story. But what it shapes up to be is really that death is a taboo that people might be worried about bringing it up. They might feel like it's making other people uncomfortable, but there is this like yearning to talk about it.
So hearing someone like Nicole Kidman saying she wants to become a death doula, how do you receive that as someone who works in this space? Is it good to have that kind of spotlight, or do you worry people might take it less seriously? How have you been feeling?
I actually think it's great. Anyone can go do a death doula certification program and increase their death literacy, because we're all going to experience loss in our life, and it can be a non-death loss as well. And just having those coping mechanisms, the language to talk about death, is really helpful. And so when I hear people like Nicole Kidman saying they're going to become a death doula, I think that's positive. It's bringing more attention to the field, but it's also showing that it's okay to talk about death and to publicize it and normalize it and show that it happens to everyone and you're going to have to deal with a death in your life.
This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor chatting with Simon Braun-Freck, who's a PhD candidate at the University of Melbourne in their death tech research team. Simon's also an end-of-life doula, maybe not something you've heard of before. Maybe you heard it for the first time when Nicole Kidman announced recently that she wants to train to become one after the death of her own mum and seeing that there. Simon, we're trying to shed a little bit of light on this role today. What are the edges of the work that you do as a doula? Where are you active and where are you kind of letting more traditional health professionals do their roles?
So the main descriptor of a doula does involve them being a non-medical role in the care team. And so they're going to leave that medical work to the medical professionals. But what a death doula can help with pre-mortem, they're going to help with advanced care planning, with other death pre-planning, with conversations about what you want your death to look like. Do you want it inside of your home? Do you want to be within a hospice facility? Do you want to be in a hospital? What makes you comfortable when you're dying? Do you want a pillow behind your head? Do you like massages or do you hate massages? Things like that. So they're going to be there for those conversations. They can also help with strife between family members, between the family and the medical team. They're really just there to act on behalf of the dying person and help make sure that their wishes are honored. And so they can be there throughout the dying process. And it's called sitting bedside. They can be there to sit at the bedside of the person dying to help the family and the dying individual understand what's going on as the process is happening. And then they can also stay post-mortem to help with funeral planning. They can often help facilitate at-home funerals, but they can't necessarily work in the role as a funeral director, but they can be there to help guide you, to help connect you with other industry partners. And so it's really dependent upon the doula and the type of work the doula does. And it can also vary depending on the type of clients a doula has. So doulas can work in pet loss. They can work with stillbirths. They can work with children. And so it's going to vary depending on who the dying individual is in that instance.
Yeah, you mentioned children there on the text line. One person says, I've wanted to be an end-of-life doula, but with young children. I think now is not my time. I think as a culture, we deny that death is coming and I want to be present to the person on the journey, especially to those who are afraid. Simon, when you mentioned young children, pregnancy loss and everything before, I realised I started to like be like, ugh, don't think about it. And that's really that taboo that you were talking about before. We're not great at thinking about and talking about these things, but if you're going through that, you really want someone who's going to be by your side.
Absolutely. And a lot of those really pivotal moments in our life that are vulnerable, confusing, hard, we haven't gone through them before. And so it's helpful to have someone who may have gone through it themselves or who has helped others go through that themselves many times so that they can tell you that these things are more conventional, more normal, that you can ask hard questions. You can be confused in that moment and it's okay to do that. And so I think often that's what a doula does, is they're just there to tell you that whatever you're feeling, whatever you're thinking, you can verbalize that and they're there to hold that space for you.
So in addition to the work that you do as an end-of-life doula, you're also a PhD candidate, you're studying this. What do you see as the future of our death culture?
I am hoping, and what I have been seeing in my research, is that death is moving back into the home. And what I mean by that is in Western death culture specifically, death used to be something that was taken care of by the family within their home. They were cleaning the body, they were dressing the body, shrouding the body, building a casket for the body, burying the body. And it was a process that took place more frequently, but also it was less professionalized. So it wasn't something shunned and tucked away and given to the industry. And so what we're seeing is that there's actually a desire for that to be happening again, for death to be brought back into the home, so that people have a more hands-on relationship with death. And if that's what you want, I think that's amazing. And I think that is the trend that's happening. I personally would want that for my own death. But that's not to say that other types of death aren't a good death is often a term people hear. And so it's really, to me, what I would hope is that death can be personalized and it can look however you want it to look. And I think that is where we're trying to go. And I think that's what the movement of bringing death back into the home is at its core. And that shouldn't disclude all of the other types of deaths and burials. Really, it should be, what do you want and how can we work to make that happen?
Well, Simon, thank you so much for joining me today. Simon Braun-Freck is a PhD student in the School of Engineering and the Death Tech Research Team at the University of Melbourne. On ABC Radio National, this is Life Matters. Thanks so much for your text today. We talked earlier about food in the system of like hospitals, aged care, daycare, and how well we do that in Australia. It's something that we spend more than $2 billion on, according to a new report. And you told me about your experiences with this centralized food system. One text says, this is a bit of an overshare, but after having a baby, passing a bowel movement is very scary. My hospital provided white bread, soft drink, and cookies as a post-birth meal. Meals like this do not help one go to the toilet. I imagine this is true for many hospital patients. We also spoke about music and how you find new music and not just get stuck in the nostalgia spiral that I am prone to. Samantha says, I'm 55 and only listen to RN, ABC Classic and Triple J. My 15-year-old only streams music. When we're in the car, we listen to Triple J together, which is how I found out about Lola and her great song Messy. I found her on YouTube and had the song on repeat for a period, then moved on. I rarely listen to my faves from my youth. I remain open and curious about everything new. Lisa says, I have a son in a psych rock band, so I switch between RN and Triple J. And when I'm wanting some nostalgia, I head over to Double J. My latest discoveries are Ray and Sky Newman. Well, that is just about it for Life Matters. I've come to you today from Jagera and Turrbal land, but don't worry, I will be back with you again tomorrow. We're going to talk about the fact that the world is basically a bin fire at the moment. At least that's the prevailing message we get almost constantly. But what if instead of meeting that news with cynicism, we met it with hope and optimism? Also tomorrow, cathedrals seem to always arrive fully formed, several hundreds of years old, but Sydney is building a brand new one. What are the design rules for a cathedral? That's tomorrow on Life Matters. I'll catch you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.